Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, March 1st. Back with us now, Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent for The Nation magazine. Some of you remember he was legal editor for the Radiolab series on the Supreme Court called More Perfect. And Ellie has a new book called Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. This is the book that says, among many other things, that the law is not science, it's more like jazz. We'll see what's in the book, as well as talk about some of today's jazzy legal news, including the Ketanji Brown Jackson Supreme Court nomination, the trouble the Trump real estate fraud investigation is reportedly in now in the Manhattan DA's office, and maybe a few other things. Ellie, always great to have you. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks for having me, Brian. How are you?
Good, thank you. There are many takes on the Constitution out there already. So what was your central organizing principle in writing a book on your take?
It's bad. The Constitution is a problem.
A problem.
Look, this is a document that was written by slavers, colonists, and wealthy white people who were willing to make deals with slavers and colonists. And it has some really obvious flaws and problems. You know, the law is not objective. It picks winners and losers. It can be applied objectively. That's a little bit different. But in terms of what it actually says, it's an argument. And right now, or at least historically speaking, the argument made by the slavers and colonists has been ascendant. And so my book is kind of explaining how that is, kind of in plain English, and trying to get people kind of motivated and excited to win the other side of the argument.
Well, we'll get into some of the particulars, but on that large view, if the Constitution originally established white male dominance, allowing slavery and voting rights only for white male property owners and black people to be counted as 3/5 of a human and the census and everything else, how far, in your view, has that been remedied, at least on paper, through all the constitutional amendments that added equal protections?
Yeah, it would be great if those constitutional amendments were actually interpreted as useful by the conservatives who control the Supreme Court. But unfortunately, those amendments have not been. If you look at something like the 15th Amendment, right, ratified in the aftermath of the Civil War and then ignored for 100 years. I mean, so a big part of my book is trying to explain that when you allow conservatives, whatever they're calling themselves, you know, after the Civil War, they called themselves Democrats. Before, now they call themselves Republicans. I don't care what they call themselves in the morning. When you look at what conservatives have done to things like the 15th Amendment, they are completely able to ignore the amendments that are supposed to give justice and equality and fairness to all people when you let them control the courts. That's what they did with the 15th Amendment. Then we have the 1965 Voting Rights Act. I would argue that the 1965 Voting Rights Act is the most important piece of legislation in American history, specifically because it makes the 15th Amendment real, and you can't have a democracy without universal suffrage. So you have the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act is so effective that within, you know, 40 or so years of taking the white oppressive foot off of our necks, we have a black president. That's great. Conservatives like that so much that they that they replaced him with a bigoted con man, and in 2013 re-eviscerated the Voting Rights Act with John Roberts and Shelby County v. Holder. So now we're back to a situation where we don't really have universal suffrage in this country. This is what conservatives do. And so when you talk to me about constitutional amendments, I'm going to talk to you about how conservatives have interpreted those amendments throughout history.
Well, let's go to one of the particulars, because you argue that there's a lot of the hypocrisy. And of course, you just mentioned one of the big particulars, the way the Supreme Court overturned the Voting Rights Act, which was passed by Congress, including a 98-0 vote in the Senate, which included obviously a lot of Republicans as well as Democrats. But the principle hypocrisy in the ways conservative justices and politicians interpret the Constitution, that is improvised jazz, on their political saxophones, I guess, while claiming to be strict originalists when it comes to the progressive agenda. So you want to talk about that duality? Because I think that's really central to so much that we see come before the Supreme Court today.
Right. So here's one of my chapters is on the Eighth Amendment. That's the amendment prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment. And I like that because that to me is the cleanest divisiveness, right? The cleanest break between originalists and progressives, right? The Eighth Amendment says that we can't have cruel and unusual punishment. That phrase is itself vague, right? I think we all understand that the Constitution does not define what cruel is and does not define what unusual is, right? So we have to go to the interpretive theories, right? The originalists, conservatives, will say that to understand what cruel and unusual punishment means, we have to look back to the men who wrote it. Now, as I pointed out, those men were slavers and colonists. Why would I, a black man in 2022, give one hoot about what slavers thought cruel and unusual should mean? Can we not agree that their moral capacity to understand cruelty was maybe stunted? How is what they thought punishments could be, what punishments could be used, how is that relevant to our lives in 2022? I say it is not. But that is the break. Conservatives want to always hold us back, not bring us back, hold us back to a 19th century, 18th century view of human rights and equality, and I want to bring us forward.
And the book mentions citing the Constitution to weaken labor laws and environmental laws based on what you call unenumerated rights. Is that something you can discuss, including why the phrase unenumerated rights is important?
Yeah. So James Madison did not think that the Bill of Rights was necessary, right? Like all the guys who wrote the like Madison, Jefferson, and Hamilton, and all the people who wrote the Federalist Papers, they thought the Constitution was fine as is. It was other people in the states, political people, who demanded a Bill of Rights. And Madison's worry about writing the Bill of Rights, which he eventually caved, he did what they wanted. Madison's worry about writing the Bill of Rights was that in the future, some fool would think that the only rights that we had were the ones enumerated on his list. And Madison knew that he couldn't possibly write down every single right a person might have or might have in the future. So Madison gave himself an out. It's called the Ninth Amendment. And the Ninth Amendment says specifically that the rights listed in the Constitution are not a conclusive list of all possible rights, that there are unenumerated rights that have not been listed in Madison's Bill of Rights. Now, that Ninth Amendment, that is, you know, again, Madison's out clause for the thing that he was forced to do, is the one amendment that conservatives want to pretend never happened. I mean, literally, conservatives will walk around talking about, like, well, the Ninth Amendment is kind of an inkblot, and who can know what it really means? I'll tell you what it really means. It means that we have more rights than are in the Constitution. The Constitution says so.
Your analogy that the law is not science, it's more like jazz. Why that?
Because like I said, it's iterations on a theme. Look, our legal system is adversarial in nature, right? There are other legal systems in other parts of the world that are not like that. We chose to have this adversarial system, which means there's always an argument, right? And so when people think that the law is objective, they think that like some kind of head disembodied voice from on high is going to tell them what the law is. No, that's not how it works. The law is an argument between, from my perspective, between forces of good and forces of evil. And too often, the forces of good don't take the field to argue for their version of freedom, equality, and justice. And my book is trying to inspire people to take the field and to take up the fight, because I honestly believe, Brian, and you know this from many conversations that we've had before, I believe that if more people understood the law, then more people would be outraged by what Republicans do to it and be committed to changing it. The law is complicated, but it is not beyond the grasp of most literate people. You just have to explain it without all the jargon and all the legalese and all the boringness, frankly. And I try to do that to get people to see what's really happening. Because I really think that if people understood what was happening, they'd care more about fixing it.
Certainly in this political environment and probably anyone that we can foresee in the near future to throw out the Constitution and start from scratch with a new constitutional convention, it would probably wind up more regressive than the one we have now. Or do you disagree?
I think that's because who would get to choose the delegates, right? If you actually chose the delegates as just a cross-section of American humans, I think the Constitution will work out a lot better. But unfortunately, we've got, you know, pro-insurrectionists who would get to have be overrepresented in the delegation. We'd have the same problem where land would have more of a say in the delegation than people, right? So if you have a constitutional convention and you've got like 10 delegates from New York, how many should you have from Wyoming? Right? Statistically, like 0.2 of a person. Like you should have a 2-year-old, essentially. Should be your reps, right? But it wouldn't work out that way, right? So the unequalness that we have baked into our society, unfortunately, I believe,
right,
would show itself again at a new constitutional convention, which is why I'm not in favor of a new constitutional convention.
Yeah, because of the Senate, which is part of the Constitution, and that's a whole show in itself.
Did you know, Brian, that the Senate is the one thing that cannot be amended through the amendment process? Like literally in the Constitution, it says that the equal suffrage in the Senate is the one thing that can't be amended through the normal amendment process. Tell me that these people didn't know what they were doing when they were making their slave state.
Viola in Kew Gardens, you're on WNYC with Ellie Mistal. Hi, Viola.
Hi, I have a quick question. It's a very, very, very fascinating conversation. I think that maybe perhaps the difficulty for a lot of people with understanding the law and the Constitution is that the nature of what justice is and the relationship between justice, equity, fairness, it's not clear. It's just like, you know, we talk about people following the law. There's the law and then there's the spirit of the law. So if people understood what the spirit of the law is, they wouldn't look for loopholes in written laws to break and say that I'm not breaking the law, because everyone wants to think about the spirit of the law. So my question is to you, what is the relationship, kind of philosophically but also pragmatically, between justice, the nature of justice, and fairness and equity? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks for a wonderful question. You have 3 hours to answer Viola's question.
Thanks for your question, Viola. Look, I always go back to who's doing the interpreting of the law. That's where the rubber meets the road, Viola, right? So, like, let's look at something like the Fourth Amendment, right? Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. Well, what's unreasonable? Who gets to decide unreasonable? According to the current conservative interpretation of the Constitution, the cop gets to decide whether his use of force was reasonable or not against me. That's who gets the reasonableness has to be judged by an average cop on the scene. What the heck is that? How is that our law? I would say that an objective non-cop should be the person to decide whether a use of force was reasonable or unreasonable. So often, Viola, it comes down not to the spirit versus the text, right? Because I think that there is broad agreement that we should pay attention to the text. There is broad agreement that we should interpret the text kind of generously as opposed to pedantically. But the real question becomes, who gets to do the interpreting? Historically, if you let conservatives do the interpreting, they will always interpret it against freedom, against equality, and against fairness and justice.
Just on your cop example, maybe a little pushback. Wouldn't a proper way to scrutinize the behavior of anybody in their situation to look at what a reasonable course of action would be for someone in their situation?
Right. Well, this is the standard, right? That you judge the cop based on what another cop should do. But the problem with that, Brian, is that what if the cops are unreasonable? What if the cops are unreasonable? Then you have a huge problem. So instead of judging the whether or not the Constitution applies to my situation based on the view of the cop, why wouldn't we judge it based on the view of the victim? why wouldn't we judge it based on the view of a person who had no skin in that conflict? Why wouldn't we judge it based on science or something like that? Like there are lots of different ways we could judge it. Deciding to judge it from the perspective of the officer is why we're here. Mm-hmm. It's why we have this problem.
One more call. Neil in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC with Ellie Mistal. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Ellie. I've listened to some of your conversations before. They're wonderful and amazing and so, you know, clarifying. My question is about Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, which, you know, I had some basic education in. I'm not an attorney. And it talks about the state legislatures getting to choose the electors for the president any way they want. And only until 2020 election, where now legislatures across the country are superseding the right to vote of citizens and putting the state legislatures in charge, including overriding the election professionals, who even Republican election professionals have, for the most part, been professionals and counted votes honestly. We look at Georgia. And now, but the Constitution seems to give this loophole that legislatures can do whatever they want, and that's very frightening. Please help me not be so frightened.
I mean, it's not a loophole, right? It's the Constitution working as intended. The Constitution did not want everybody to vote and to everybody to have a voice. The Constitution was horribly restrictive in who it gave the rights to vote. Remember, initially, it wasn't even people couldn't even choose their senators. That was done through the state legislatures. That had to be amended out. The Electoral College is a system designed to remove the president from popular election. We should change it. I don't know what else to say. Like people only seem to. There's so much of our laws that are based on the presumption of good faith, and I think that when I say it's a black guy's guide to the Constitution, this is kind of what I'm talking about. It's an assumption of good faith that I believe you can only make if you've been white for your whole life. Right? Because if you've been black for your whole life, you kind of are like you kind of won't assume that white people will always be acting in good faith. And you certainly wouldn't build a government around the concept of white people acting in good faith, because sometimes they don't. And so you would write a document that had some protections against white people acting in bad faith. And that's what our Constitution doesn't have. Our Constitution kind of assumes good faith at various points where it shouldn't.
Neil, thank you for your call. We're almost out of time. I was planning to spend more time on some current legal news than it turns out that we have the time for, because the stuff from your book is so interesting. But maybe we can do a sort of lightning round version on a couple of things. The nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. I saw a conservative column in The Hill that argued Michelle Childs, who Congressman Jim Clyburn was promoting, would have been a better pick for conservatives because he has more moderate constitutional views on a number of things. So I wonder if you could do like a soundbite version of putting Judge Brown Jackson somewhere on the spectrum of constitutional thought.
First of all, if conservatives like Michelle Childs so much, they should nominate her when they have the opportunity to. I'd welcome that. I will not pigeonhole Ketanji Brown Jackson, but I will say that her decisions have been extremely mainstream. She clerked for Breyer, who himself was a very mainstream centrist judge. Her decisions have been kind of straight down the center, mainstream. However, I would not worry about her progressive bona fides, if that's something that you're concerned about, because when you look at her personal history, she has worked as a federal public defender. She comes to the Supreme Court, if confirmed, she will come to the Supreme Court with more public defense experience than any justice since Thurgood Marshall. And she's also worked on the U.S. Sentencing Commission, which is a huge issue of disparate justice. So I think she both has conservative bona fides while also making extremely kind of normal mainstream decisions. I do not think that anybody should have anything to worry about with her.
And last thing, the Trump real estate fraud case. I saw you comment on that on the local station New York One. Do you get what's happening there? Reportedly, two prosecutors working on the case have resigned because the new Manhattan DA has doubts. But the state attorney general, Letitia James, is pressing forward with her own investigation, I think, on the same facts. So what the heck is going on here?
Well, there's a little bit of a difference between Letitia James pushing forward on civil charges, whereas Bragg, the DA, was supposed to go forward on criminal charges. Look, I think Bragg has a lot to answer for here. He can't just say, well, it's a hard case to make. Because, yes, we understand it was a hard case to make. You brought in Mark Pomerantz, who's a professional RICO lawyer, to make that hard case. You have Dunn, who has been there for a long time making that hard case. And they obviously thought they still had a case to make. So Bragg needs to explain not just why he thought it was a hard case to make, but why he overruled the non-political appointee prosecutors in his own office against that case. And he has to explain how that's any different than Cy Vance before, in the before times, overruling the prosecutors in his own office and refusing to go after the Trump Organization in 2015, 2012, and the previous times. Bragg could answer that question. But he needs to come out here and answer the question because right now it looks pretty bad.
All right. Unresolved. And there we leave it with Elie Mostal, justice correspondent for The Nation. His new book is called Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. The problem when you come on, Elie, it's always so boring. You know, I see people's eyes drooping behind the wheels of their cars, everything. So
the law, man, it's got to slap people awake with that stuff.
Thanks, Elie. We will talk.
Thanks so much.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.